Hello, and thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. When you're finished with this one, you can help yourself to more than 1,000 other podcasts, all free, on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or through iTunes.
How's that?
I think
one day I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that were the case?
Oh, no, so, that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day,
I will never accept
it. It was
that.
Like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And look, I don't know, it's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Gives me great pleasure to tell you that Miriam Margolyes returns to Conversations today. Miriam is touring Australia at the moment with her production of Dickens Women, where she plays 23 different characters on stage from the great man's novels. And I've got to tell you, seeing her do this on stage is a revelation. Watching her inhabit the characters, like Miss Havisham from Great Expectations and the drunken Mrs. Gamp is amazing, but seeing her transmute from one to the other is like a fabulous magic trick. Miriam Margolyes has won acclaim for her performances in many films, including the Martin Scorsese movie The Age of Innocence. She was, of course, Professor Sprout in the Harry Potter films, Queen Victoria in Blackadder, and even the voice of Fly, the dog, in the movie Babe. And she's currently been on screen, on the small screen, in Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries on ABC One. Welcome back, Miriam.
Lovely, and thank you for that list of my accomplishments.
Oh, there's many more. I mean, I could, the hour would be up.
No, it makes me feel that I'm dead when people start listing things.
Now, last time on the program, you're mad keen for genealogy, and you've got a really interesting family history too. You just discovered that your great-grandfather was a criminal. Did that shock the family when you discovered that?
Yes, it did, and I was quite surprised because I thought, you know, it's about 150 years ago, it doesn't really matter. But they were all rather anxious that it should be kept hush-hush, which of course I wasn't prepared to do. But I was thrilled to bits. Now, he was sentenced in 1877, and if it had been 7 years earlier, it would have meant that I could have been an Australian now, because he would have been transported in 1870. But that's when transportation stopped. So he was sent to Parkhurst, Isle of Wight, which is nothing like Australia.
No, it's not. So he wasn't transported. So are you not... I don't think you were quite a citizen last time we saw you. I know you spent part of the year in Australia. Are you a citizen yet?
I'm not a citizen yet. I'm a resident. But I've been assured that I should put in my papers now, and that's what I'm doing. I have a very good immigration lawyer in Sydney, and I hope that they will receive this 70-year-old dyke, you know. It's
the humble petition.
Yes. Please, sirs.
Admit me to your nice country. I've paid me passage and everything, I have. Well, I'm surprised that hasn't happened yet, actually, because you're a fine ambassador for Australia. You always say nice things about the place when you travel.
I love Australia. What's not nice? I mean, it's a great country, and there is a sense of fairness and decency about the people, which I really warm to. And there's no class system, and that I love. I'm saddled with this posh, pommy voice, which I could... If I was very clever, I could just talk like that, because that's how my parent, you know, my father was from Glasgow, so he would have talked like that. And if I talked like that, I think people would like me better. But, you know, I was born in Oxford, and that's the voice I've got now. So I've just to go back to what I really am. But I think that it does put people off a bit, because here in Australia, you can't tell that much about people from their voices. And that's wonderful. Whereas in England, everything is revealed.
Still, that voice of yours is very authoritative. It must get you into all sorts of places where you might otherwise be ignored.
Gets me into trouble because I think I'm naughty, and I can't help being naughty. But I want connection with people. That's the thing I love so much. And that's really why I'm very grateful to Harry Potter, not just for the money, which was useful, but because it's meant that lots more people know me than knew me before. And whereas before they always say, what is it you're in? I've seen your face lots of times, you know, but now they know who I am because of Harry Potter.
Why do people do that? They want you to stand and recite your acting CV in front of them while you're out doing the shopping or something. It's not nice, is it? It's rather embarrassing.
No, that irritates me. And I always say, look, I don't know what you've seen, so I'm not going to run through my CV just for you. But I am an actress, and if you want my autograph, I'll give it to you, and if not, please go away.
Which is the correct response to this sort of thing. Great Expectations, the new BBC production, has just been shown. We'll talk about Dickens for a bit. It's just been shown on ABC One. May I ask you what you thought of that adaptation?
I was fascinated to see it. I think that there's lots of good things in it, and some things I can't accept at all. Principally, that fine actress, Gillian Anderson, is totally miscast as Miss Havisham. She's much, much too young, and she's too active. She's running up and down stairs. No, that's not Miss Havisham. That's not how Dickens wrote it. But I do think that Magwitch is fantastic. Ray Winston, I think, is absolutely perfect as Magwitch. I think Pip is more beautiful than Estella, and that isn't quite right for me.
There's no end to these ruby-lipped, male model actors that Rada seems to be able to throw onto the screen, is there?
It's the Botox.
I thought it was a dreadful production myself, and I stopped my kids from watching it because it was just such a silly adaptation. It was way too extreme, and you got Magwitch throwing all the money, and here's your inheritance, Pip, and dumping it in front of him. It was just silly. I stopped and made them watch the David Lean film from 1946.
Ah, well, now that is probably the greatest adaptation of any novel anywhere in the world. That is a wonderful piece of work and memorable. I mean, don't you remember that moment when Magwitch yanks Pip from the gravestone? It's the most terrifying moment in film.
The children relate to it completely and instantly, and they feel the cold terror of it at once.
Absolutely.
Now, the thing about Dickens is it's kind of grotesque to begin with, or feverish. I don't know how you describe Dickens. That world, it doesn't need to be amped up very much, does it, really? It's already there in the story.
I agree with you. People say that Dickens is an overlarder of people and events. I don't see it like that. I think the Dickens world is a parallel world. I don't think it's exactly the same as our world. The colours are brighter, the voices are more varied, and the passion is stronger. It's a parallel world, but it is a real world. And when you're tugged into it, as you are when you read his books, at least I am, I feel that I'm dancing in a strange ether, an amazing construct that I want to be part of, and yet at the same time I'm scared of it. There is a power in Dickens, and that's what I'm trying to get over in my show. It's hard sometimes because it's just me, and I'm only doing 23 of 2,000 characters that he created, but he is a magical writer, and we're incredibly lucky that we're reading him in the language that he wrote. We're not like reading Tolstoy when we're reading translations of Russian. We're reading the language that he wrote in. We're seeing the words on the page just as he saw them. And for me, that is a thrill.
I was waiting for you to show up in a Harry Potter film sooner or later, because you seem to fit into those worlds, these larger-than-life worlds of Dickens, Harry Potter. They're not quite the same, I know, but why do you think you fit so well into those worlds, Miriam?
Because I've got big breasts. Well, it's not totally untrue. I think size... and I am too fat. I am a too fat woman.
No, I'm not referring to your size at all. It's your mind.
Referring to my size, but underneath.
No, I was
you
not.
Were.
I was not, because thin people fit into that world as well. And it's your kind of your presence rather than your physicality.
I think that I have within me a kind of boiling energy, which is what Dickens had, and I think what the films of Harry Potter have. And so the fact that I was lucky enough to play Professor Sprout, I think it is quite right.
And big breasts didn't hold you back.
No, they haven't, except from being in the pole vaulting team.
One day, you'll show them. I'm the wonderful Miriam Margolyes today, whose production of Dickens Women is touring Australia. Now, when we last spoke, I hadn't seen the show, and I saw it that night after our first conversation about 5 years ago, and it's just completely wonderful. And you begin with Mrs. Gamp, the drunken midwife.
I do. And, you know, people have told me that the show is very different this time. And I say, how can that be? Because the text is exactly the same. But you know what? I've changed, and I've got better. And this is what I want to tell anybody who happened to see the show before. I'm better now than I was then.
How? How? In what way? Lots of little ways or in a big way?
I can't tell you exactly how because I don't see myself. But people who've seen both shows have told me that there's something deeper and more profound in it. And I think that's partly because I've got older. You know, now I'm 70 and my perspective on life must have changed a little bit. I'm more vulnerable, I suppose, as you are when you're older. And this has come out in the text. It's come out in the way I deliver the text. The text itself is the same. Because when Sonia Fraser and I developed this show, we developed it very specifically, and I don't want to change anything in it. But I've got better at doing it, and that means it's a better show. But I would just like to tell you that there is another show on at the moment at QPAC, which is...
In Brisbane?
In Brisbane. And there is a most amazing young performer. She's a Brisbane girl, and this is her first return to her native city. Her name is Kristen O'Leary, and the show is called Bombshells. I saw it last night at a preview, and I was completely bowled over by it. She's wonderful. And she plays several parts, not as many as I do, but
she'll get there when she's 70.
Well, she'll be way ahead of me. And she sings amazingly. She's got a wonderful singing voice. And it's just a terrific evening in the theatre.
It's very generous of you to endorse another actor's work like that.
Well, I'm just a lovely person. That has to be said.
Can I talk about Mrs. Gamp a bit more? Because
she's
not a lovely person, is she? Gin-soaked midwife, and that's a terrifying thought to begin with, isn't it?
It is. When Dickens wrote her, when he invented her, he said to his friend John Forster, he said, "I mean to make a mark with her." And he has. She's probably the best thing in that book, which is Martin Chuzzlewit, which is an early book. He was quite still a young man. But there's that mixture of comedy and evil, which is a very Dickensian quality, the merging of those two. And she's triumphant. Would you like me to do a little tiny bit of her?
I'd love you to do a little bit of Mrs. Gamp, please.
She's a drunken midwife. And in those days, midwives also laid out corpses. They had a dual role.
What? They would do both things?
Yes.
Bring children into the world?
Hatching and dispatching, yes. That was her speciality. And so when somebody called her, she didn't know whether they were going to be a baby or a corpse. And I think that's rather adorable, and that's why I opened my show with her. But she is a bit of a drinker. She is gin-soaked, as many of those nurses were in those days. And who knows, maybe even now. Did I say that? No, I don't. I think nurses are wonderful people. But she does tend to be a bit garrulous. And she says things like, "Leave the bottle on the chimney piece. And don't ask me to take none, but let me put my lips to it when I'm so disposed, and I will do everything I've been engaged to do according to the best of my ability." And she says things like...
"Let me put my lips to it."
Yeah,
I
know, well,
love
isn't that
line.
Wonderful? And she says things like... "When Gamp," that's her dead husband, "when Gamp was summoned to his long home, and I seen him lying in the hospital with a penny piece on each eye and his wooden leg under his left arm, I thought I should have fainted away, but I bore up."
Oh, that's terrific. That's fantastic. When you do comic roles, you're quite a dangerous comic performer. And I mean that in the best sense of the word. The best comic performers, for mine, have a sense of unpredictability to them, and it makes them dangerous on stage. And, the greatest guy I can think of that is Eric Morecambe, as in Eric and Ernie. Ernie would stand very still, and Eric would just kind of move around him. And you'd just be waiting and waiting and waiting, dangerous and unpredictable. You have that kind of thought. Does that mean holding two thoughts in your head at the same time when you're trying to be that way?
I'm not conscious of doing so, and I'm very interested that you think that I'm dangerous and unpredictable. I'm quite glad of it. But I, funnily enough, I don't like comedy. I don't see comedy as a separate part of of art or acting or anything. I hate the thought that at the BBC and presumably at the ABC there's a comedy department. I just think it's part of life and we ought to be able to be funny and horrifying almost at the same time, which is exactly what Dickens did, of course. But I like the idea of being dangerous because now I'm only 4 foot 11. I used to be 5 foot. Now, that is a change that's happened over the years. I've lost an inch and I've put it round my waist, I think.
Haven't we all? You once said you got advice from an actor or director, a director, I think, to play the opposite on stage. Play the opposite. What does that mean?
Yes, Max Stafford Clarke gave me that advice, who is a very fine director and a rather unpleasant man. I don't like him, but I do remember that piece of advice. And what he means is that nobody is just one thing. We all have layers and depths and different facets. And if you know that your character is a, let us say, a funny character, you must almost always show them also in moments of melancholy, because that makes it more believable and you understand a person better. So although you probably see me as a very confident and maybe amusing person, I have moments of deep distress and anxiety when I'm none of those things. I'm not funny, I'm needy and frightened. And that is part of my personality, as it is in most people's, I think. So I think it's very important to show all sides of a person and not take the easy way out. So when you see a character come on stage, you mustn't demonstrate to the audience everything about that character. You have to let out little bits here and there, and then they get the sense of a whole person.
Do you think that holy terror of, oh, I might not be any good, that thought, is the kind of dynamo that actors need?
I don't know if all actors need it. I certainly do, and I do always feel quite frightened just before I go on stage. I don't feel terrified except at first nights when I do something for the very first time. And then I sweat buckets, and gradually as the run goes on, I'm sweating less and less. So it isn't a constant terror, but there is always a fear just before I go on as Mrs. Gamp. Will I do it right? Will I please them? Will I be as good as I can be? There's always that doubt.
Brenda Blethyn said the same thing when she was on the program. And she said it's very common amongst actors to get nerves before going on stage every single time, no matter how old you get and how long you've been doing it. It's very common.
I think that's true. And Brenda, who is a wonderful actress and a friend of mine, would know that. And obviously she told you so. I think it's very foolish to be smug about your work. That's one of the reasons I never read reviews, because if they're bad, you get depressed, and if they're good, you get smug. And when you get smug, the truth goes out of your work, and that is the only thing that matters in your work, is to be truthful.
She said you also have to be a champion for your characters, no matter how much the audience dislikes them. And when she was playing Mrs. Bennet in Pride and Prejudice, one of the most annoying, unlikable characters, she said, she will defend Mrs. Bennet and say, she is like this for this and this reason. And you, to be a good actress, a good actor, you need to be able to do that. You need to be your character's champion. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. I put it in a slightly different way. I would say you must never comment on your character. You have to be inside that person and therefore see the world through that person's eyes and interpret events through that person's eyes, rather than say to the audience, look at this awful woman or look at this terrifying person. You have to go inside the character, which I imagine is what Ralph Fiennes did when he was playing that wicked Nazi in Schindler's List. It was an amazing performance because you saw how a human being could be a devil.
Yes, there was something recognisably human in that portrayal that made it so troubling. That's the troubling bit. And are you feeling the same way about the dreadful Mrs. Gamp when you were portraying Mrs. Gamp?
No, I don't feel... I mean, I don't feel she's a devil because I'm inside Mrs. Gamp. I'm interpreting the world according to Mrs. Gamp. And when she says, rich folks may ride on camels, but it ain't so easy for them to see out of a needle's eye. She believes that, and I believe it when I say it.
Are you talking about the kind of outsized world that Charles Dickens creates? Do you think he sees the world as a child? That's all his books are a way of looking at the world through a child's eyes?
I do. I think he never lost that clear, unflinching gaze of the child. I think he regarded himself as a child who had been neglected and possibly not abused in a sexual way, but cruelly treated a little by particularly his mother. And I think that influenced the whole of the rest of his life. He wrote, I think, the first book in which a child was a protagonist, Oliver Twist. And all the children in his books are not pathetic creatures exactly, but creatures who call out your compassion, like Tom the crossing sweeper in Bleak House, and Little Nell, and Smike. These are children who have been damaged by life, and I think he felt that he had been damaged by life, and he never forgot it. He carried that pain and hurt around with him.
His books are a kind of an act of self-pity, then?
You can't call works of such great art self-pity. That would be denigrating them, I think. But I believe that his attitude to himself was one of someone who had been hurt.
Your play, Dickens' Women, is a kind of an expose in many ways. I won't go into the details because it's kind of a nice thing to discover on stage about what Dickens was really like and his attitudes towards women. After having discovered all this and performing it on stage, do you still love him after knowing all about his selfishness and silliness?
It goes back to what I said about people having many facets, and we know they do. Well, Dickens was like that. I loathe many of the things about the man, and these are the things that I reveal during the show, so I'm not going to say them now. But I love him for his work. I love that talent. I love that use of words. Words are the currency of thought. If we have great words, we will have great thoughts. And the way that he uses words is majestic. It is thrilling to me. And that's why I always tell people, read him aloud if you find him difficult. If the size of the books disturbs you, just go page at a time and read it aloud, as he did when he was creating. And that's what I love about him. I love that gift that he had of making a song out of every sentence. They're just blissful sentences.
Every year, Miriam, you go to the annual week-long International Dickens Universe Conference in California somewhere. What on earth goes on there?
Well, do you know, it is a place where nuts congregate, I must tell you. There's something about Dickens that attracts slightly balmy people. And a lot of the people who go are slightly balmy. It's a gathering of scholars and of enthusiasts. And that's why it's so lovely, because it's not just English people at universities talking in a rather abstract way about deconstruction and so on, although that happens too. But it's also just Jim and John and Fanny and Sybil just talking about bits of novels that they've loved and sharing memories of seeing productions and, you know, people who love Dickens.
And do they dress up?
We do. I don't, actually. Because I'm not very good at dressing up, as you see from ridiculous clothes I'm wearing. But I do enjoy seeing them dress up. And we have a Victorian tea on the lawn at Santa Cruz, which is where it's held, and lovely little teacups. And it's a bit absurd. I know it is. But I have a wonderful time.
But aren't people bothering you to do Mrs. Gamp all the time while you're there or something else? Do you mind?
I don't mind at all. My idea of fun is to be asked to read Dickens. And we study a novel every year. There is a novel picked as the novel of the year. And this year, it is Great Expectations. So I'm looking forward to reading it aloud to a group of like-minded enthusiasts.
Great Expectations is the character of Estella in Great Expectations. Do you really think a person like that could really be created? A person who could be brought up to be divorced from any kind of love?
I've never thought about that. Yes, I think that if you have control of a child from an early age, you can bring them up to be almost anything. Isn't that what the Jesuits said? You know, give me a child before he's seven and he's mine for life. And I think that could be. That is why I think Gillian Anderson isn't quite right as Miss Havisham, because she's not malignant enough. And you have to feel both pity and revulsion about Miss Havisham. And you don't. You feel pity for Gillian Anderson's Miss Havisham, but not revulsion.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Conversations broadcast, podcast, and online.
The amazing Miriam Margolyes is with me in conversation today. Miriam is touring around Australia at the moment with her production of Dickens' Women, where she portrays 23 characters from the novels of Charles Dickens on stage. Now, India. Miriam, you've just been to India. You've recently been to India for Ayurveda treatment. What is that, and what did you do?
Well, I call it Ayurvedic treatment.
Okay.
I don't know which is right.
I'm sure you're correct. It sounds more like an adjective than the word I used. I think I used a noun, yes.
And I did it because I wanted to be really fit to do this tour around Australia, because it's a four-month tour and, you know, I'm an old lady and I need to make sure I'm fit. So I went to a spa for 6 weeks and every day I had an oil enema.
That's a good time or is it a bad time?
It was a wonderful experience.
Was it?
And I've also become vegetarian. I eat fish and eggs, but no cheese and no meat and no poultry.
Well, that's are you going to stay that way, do you think?
Or is that's for life.
Are you feeling better since you've had this treatment? And
very much so. Yes? Very much so. I have more energy and my poo doesn't smell. It's an amazing thing.
Does one surrender one's dignity at these spas?
A little bit, I think, yes. But it's not a bad thing to let go of. We all hang on to our dignity too much. And, you know, when you're having something stuck up your asshole, you can't really sort of put on airs and graces because there's nowhere to put them.
You can't act like the Duchess of Kent under those circumstances,
well,
can you?
I don't know how she behaves, but yes, exactly. But it was wonderful, and it is a very serious and ancient method of Indian medicine. And it wasn't so much a spa, it wasn't a beauty spa that I went, it was a clinic where people go to be cured of real problems. I didn't have real problems, I just needed to detoxify. And every day, apart from the oil enema, we also had a massage on our heads and all over our bodies for an hour and a half. It was gorgeous.
Well, it's nice not just to have the oil enema to look forward to each day. Massage as well.
That was the pièce de résistance at the very end.
How lovely. And it worked. You're in better shape now, as you say.
Yes, I really feel that I have more energy and more fizz than I did before.
We were talking about family and genealogy earlier. Do you think you're more like your mother or your father, Miriam?
I'm like my father facially, down to the moustache as well, and I'm like my mother physically because she was a stout lady and unfortunately so am I. But I don't have her singing ability. I have my father's non-singing ability. So I am a complete mixture of my mother and father, who were adorable people, and I am deeply grateful to them. I was not neglected, unlike Dickens, quite the opposite. I was the only child and I was really spoilt and petted over, and I had a wonderful childhood. And I wish that my parents could have known that I have done all right.
You offered yourself as a life model to an extraordinary artist, Augustus John. Tell me that story, how you became his life model, Miriam, and how old were you at the time?
I was 17, and I was not a bad-looking woman then, and he was on a television program called Face to Face with John Freeman, which was a sort of interviewed person to person. And I just fell in love with him. I thought he was adorable. This naughty, vivid old man who was such a great draftsman. He was really a better draftsman than painter. And so I wrote to him and said, would you like me to be your model? And he said, his wife rang up, Dorelia, and my parents for some reason said yes. I don't know, I can't imagine why they said yes, but they did. And they took me to his studio in Fordingbridge, and I stripped off, and he rumbled appreciatively. He said,
he said, yes, nice, very nice. The your body takes the light.
Well, of course it does.
And it was an amazing experience. We played Shove Ha'penny, which I'd never heard of before. It's a sort of board game that people played in pubs in England.
In the nude? Or you clothed at the time?
No, I was clothed. The nude part was fairly brief. I mean, it was, I know, a couple of hours while he did some sketches. But the Shove Ha'penny was definitely clothed.
Tell me how your mother conspired to get you into Cambridge University. This was rather clever of her, wasn't it?
Ah, she was amazing. You know, I loved being at university, and I always tell people who want to go on the stage, go to university, get an education, because that was my experience. I didn't go to drama school. But my mother was not educated. She, like Dickens, never had a proper formal education. And yet she was so clever and so shrewd. She was a great brain, but an untutored one. And when the war came and my parents relocated to Oxford because they'd heard that there were no bombs going to be dropped on Oxford because it was a beautiful city and Hitler wanted to keep it for himself. And it is true that no bombs were dropped on Oxford. And my parents went there also because their car, which was a Morris Oxford, was being repaired there. And I was born there. And my father just put up a plate and was a doctor. And one of his patients was a very great intellectual called Isaiah Berlin, who was a fellow of the Royal Society and fellow of All Souls and a very remarkable man. And my mother somehow knew that he was an important man. I don't know how she knew, because she didn't know anything about the university, but she said to my father, I want you to invite that man, Isaiah Berlin, for supper. And Daddy said, whatever for? And she said, I want you to invite him to supper because I want him to be Miriam's sponsor when she has to have someone on that form for university. I want it to be Isaiah Berlin. And he said, oh, he's not going to come, he won't. And she said, ask him, ask him. And he did come, and he did sign the form. And I can tell you, I got into Oxford and Cambridge, and I was no great brain, and I know that it was because no university in the world would turn down a sponsoree of Isaiah Berlin. It would just not happen.
No, he was one of the greatest intellectuals of his time.
Yes, he was. But how my mother knew that, she could certainly read and write. I don't mean she was illiterate, but she wasn't educated. And she always said to me, I want you to go to university because you will be able to talk to anybody about anything.
Why do you think he accepted the dinner invitation?
Because he liked my father. My father was a very sweet, decent man. He was what I call a Presbyterian Jew because he was born in Glasgow and he absorbed the culture of Scotland. So he used to cry when he heard bagpipes and, he just loved Scotland, as I do. And so he would have known. He was just a sweetheart, and Isaiah Berlin would have known that from just being a patient.
Earlier today I was looking at a website, which is a whole lot of photos of people who are now become very famous, like yourself, who were once on University Challenge. And there's a photo of you from the 1960s, and you've got a naughty look on your face, and you've got a look on your face that says, I'm going to say the F word TV. And so it came to pass. What happened there, Miriam?
I didn't mean to say it. It just popped out because I got an answer wrong. And then there was a shot of me clearly saying, oh,
F.
But the sound was miraculously removed when it went out on television. I'm embarrassed about it because it's not the right thing to do.
That's a marvellous thing. You've just recently been working with Barbara Streisand in a film. Now, you worked with her in Yentl. You were in her movie Yentl years and years and years ago.
30 years ago.
30 years ago.
I worked with Barbara Streisand, and I worked with her again this year. Oh, well, last year.
What was the job? What was the role?
I was playing a friend in a group of friends of the character that Barbara was playing in a film that is now called The Guilt Trip, but was being called My Mother's Curse when I did it. And I only had one day on it, one scene, which took all day to film. And it was great fun, and it was very special to work with her. I mean, she's a very great artist. She's a bit scary because she's not friendly like I am. You know, she's quite grand in a way, although I don't suppose she feels grand, but you just kept your distance a bit with her. But it was a wonderful experience. And I asked the director, a very nice lady, Anne Taylor, how did I get this job? You know, what made you think of me? And she said, oh, I saw you on the Graham Norton show. And you were so naughty and you made me laugh so much that I thought, oh, I'm going to have that woman. But it's just encouraging because sometimes people who see me on talk shows, especially that particular one, I'm very, very naughty and I am very rude and outspoken about sexual things and all that. And people get offended. So, you know, maybe I've alienated some people, but I did get a job at least.
Last time you were on the program, you made me laugh because you were telling me how much you don't like children because they tend to steal all the attention away from you. Now it's pool Nazis. You've got a thing about pool Nazis at the moment. Why do they bother you?
I swim every day. That's the way I try to keep fit because I don't go to the gym because I think I just look silly in a gym. And I don't like seeing people who are prettier than me. And everybody's prettier than me in a gym. So I don't go to the gym. But in the pool, there are people who pound up and down and splash and kick. And you can get quite hurt in a pool. It's a dangerous place. And I just loathe it. And once, when one chap went by, you know, I got hold of him and squeezed him where it hurts. Because I wasn't having that. I'm only small and I swim slowly. And I just won't have it if people are bullies. I don't like that.
I can guess. I guess you had his complete and total attention in that moment, Miriam.
He didn't do it again, I'll tell you.
I think he probably can't walk again, let alone swim again.
I hope not.
Magda Zabanski sought out your advice recently about coming out. What did you tell her?
Oh, what a lovely lady she is. I think it wasn't that she asked for my advice. I think she wanted to know what I thought about the fact that she was going to come out publicly. And I said to her, look, you are who you are, and you are now in your career where you are. You can do this. It's the right time to do it. If you'd done it before when you were younger, then I think it would not have been helpful to you. But now, everybody knows you, everybody loves you in Australia. It can only be a good thing. And it's good for her because she can be open and honest about who she is. And the fact that she's gay in no way changes who she is. She's always been a lovely person, a fine actress, a great comedian. And this is just something else that people now know about her. And I think everybody's absorbed it and probably says, well, so what? And that's the correct response.
Well, of course, yes. Do you envy younger gay people? It was much harder for you, of course. Much, much more difficult to gain acceptance for you.
Actually, I don't agree with you, Richard. I think it's much harder now.
Surely not.
Yes, I do. I think it's much harder now. I never found it a problem. I never found it a problem being gay. I wouldn't talk about it publicly because I felt that I wasn't going to be sacrificed on the altar of gay rights. I wanted my career. and I was totally absorbed in my own career and I wanted to get ahead. And I thought, if I have to lie, I don't care. I want to get parts as heterosexual parts. I don't only want to play old dykes. And I'm going to keep my mouth shut where I have to. Now I'm where I'm going to be. I've had a good career and I don't mind talking about it. It's irrelevant, really. But if people are so nosy and silly that they want to know about the sexual habits of a 70-year-old, well, tough titty.
How did it affect your parents when you came out to them? Because you did come out to your parents, didn't you?
I came out to my parents, and I wish I had not. I think it hurt them and worried them desperately. And I think it could have caused the stroke which felled my mother. And so I say to people, young people, don't come out to people who can't handle it. It's selfish. Because you're doing it for your own sake, to be free. And you can be free without hurting other people.
It's not right to pretend you're someone you're not, though, surely. Not in, particularly in front of your parents.
I don't think it's right to hurt people. And
I
think
it's... You pay a very high price for that.
Yes, you do.
Many people would think a much too high price.
I know, and a lot of gay people do not agree with me about this. This is something that I feel just for myself. I believe that to hurt another person is one of the most evil and wicked things that you can do. People must not be hurt. And so if they are not able to deal with that information, then don't tell them.
But there's nothing different about you coming out. You're still lovely, Miriam, the doting daughter. You know, an appreciative daughter who loves her parents. There's nothing different about you. It shouldn't really be a shock.
I know. I agree with you about all of those things. But it was too much for my parents. They just couldn't handle it. My father, who was a brilliant doctor, actually made me swear on the Holy Bible that I would not sleep with a woman again. And,
wow.
And I did swear on the Holy Bible.
But you didn't keep the vow, though, did
no,
you?
No, I didn't. And I knew at the time that I made the vow that it was not a true vow.
That's a terrible thing to force someone into an hypocrisy, surely, isn't it? Or do you just see it as acting, as a kind of acting then, playing a part?
Yes, I did. I saw it. I thought, this is something that I know that will happen again, and I'm not prepared to change myself. And I could see that my parents were in distress, and I thought it's more important that they are happy than it is that I am honest.
Julia Gillard, a Labour Prime Minister in Australia, opposes gay marriage, whereas David Cameron, Conservative Prime Minister in the UK, supports the idea. Now, you've been with your partner, what now, for 40 years or something? Would you
More than that,
More
yes.
than that now? Would you consider getting married? Do you want to get married? Does it interest you?
No, it doesn't, actually. I don't want to get married. I'm with my beloved partner, and that's fine. We're fine. Everybody has their own ways of living, and that's our way of living. I absolutely support gay marriage for those who wish it. It should be absolutely on the table. And, you know, Miss Gillard is wrong and Mr. Cameron is right on that issue. On other issues, no. I am with Miss Gillard every time.
Still, when you get married, you have a nice party and you get presents. You like presents, don't you?
I do like presents, except that people give such silly presents. I don't know what it is, but I think because I'm often a kind of laughy, trivial person, they give me silly, trivial presents, and I don't want trivial presents.
Like what?
Oh, they might give me a fart cushion or a candle. I particularly dislike candles. I want books and records. Oh, no, they don't call them records. And DVDs, that sort of thing.
I'll put it to you. If you, you know, changed your mind and did want to get married and someone gave you a fart cushion for a wedding present, they might not be your best friend, I think, under those circumstances.
No, they wouldn't be asked to the next wedding anyway.
It's interesting your dad asked you to swear on a Bible because you're a Jewish family.
Yes.
And you belong to a synagogue, don't you?
I belong to the synagogue in Streatham in London, near where I live in Clapham. And I have belonged to other synagogues, but I'm not actually a believer in God. And people say, you know, what a dreadfully hypocritical thing. No, I don't see it like that. I think that I am Jewish. I love being with other Jewish people. I don't agree with them about Israel, for example. That's a very touchy and difficult subject.
What about Israel?
Israel is wrong in its treatment of Palestinians. Israel is wrong in not allowing Palestinians to return to their homeland. And they are going to have to change or they will be destroyed. And that is a terrible thing. I went there. I saw it for myself, so I know. But I love being with Jewish people, and my heritage is a Jewish heritage. So why shouldn't I join a synagogue? I want to be part of that Jewish experience. And it's a much wider experience than just the personal interaction with the God that, for me, does not exist. I know he exists for other people, and that's fine. You know, you can have your God, and I can have my non-God.
You went to the West Bank with a charity called ActionAid. Tell me about that organisation.
ActionAid exists in Australia and in England and maybe in other countries, but I'm only aware of those two. In England, I send money to educate children in Africa and India, and I've done that for 25, 30 years. In Australia, they have particular projects, and one of the projects is to provide water for the villages in on the West Bank where the water systems have been destroyed by the Israeli settlers. And I wanted to see for myself what was going on. So I paid for myself. I want that to be very clear. I don't take money from charities. I give money to charities. So all accommodation and travel expenses I took, and that I think is the proper way when you are, if you like, a celebrity supporter of something.
And what did you see when you travelled into the West Bank?
I saw a terrible deprivation. Families living in the dust on the ground and underground with no water because the settlers in the village above had destroyed their water systems and thrown rubbish into them. And ActionAid is collecting money to rebuild those water systems so that they have a proper water supply. It is so appalling what is going on there that I'm not surprised that there is terrorism. I loathe terrorism. I think it is the wrong way to react. But I'm not surprised that that's what they're doing because it's the only way to get world attention, it seems. Nobody else bothers. And it hurts me as a Jew, who am proud of being Jewish, that my people should be doing this to others. It's wrong. And I know that Jewish people regard me as a betrayer and a loudmouth and wish I would shut up.
And what do you say to that?
I speak the truth, and you must listen.
Miriam Margulies, it's been so wonderful having you back on the program again. And thank you so much for being my guest in conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.